Hi, y'all. This is Kristen Chenoweth.
Hi, I'm Gloria Stefan.
This is Sarah Bareilles.
Hi, I'm Patti LuPone.
This is Lin-Manuel Miranda. You're listening to the Broadway Podcast Network.
Attention all theater lovers, this Sunday, April 21st, Broadway Podcast Network is holding the first ever Broadway Podfest, a full day of podcast recordings with some of your favorite Broadway stars, live from the Museum of Broadway, which is right in the heart of Times Square. The day begins at 11 a.m. Eastern and features a full day of programming that you don't want to miss. Visit bpn.fm/podfest to get all the details and register to attend for free. That's bpn.fm/podfest.
You are about to participate in the most ambitious culinary experiment ever imagined.
This competition is going to test everything.
Adapt quickly to anything. I mean anything. The wildest day of your life starts right now.
All new 24 and 24 Last Chef Standing. Sunday night at 8 on Food Network. Stream on Max.
The Vietnam War, it's over.
Your job's just begun.
A new HBO original limited series.
Welcome to the world of spycraft. Strap in.
From executive producers Park Chan-wook and Robert Downey Jr.
What are you concealing?
Based on the Pulitzer Prize-winning novel by Viet Thanh Nguyen.
What if I told you that I was a communist spy?
How did you become this?
The Sympathizer, streaming April 14th on Max. Subscription required.
Hi, I'm Rob Schneider.
And I'm Kevin David Thomas.
And this is Behind the Curtain, Broadway's Living Legends. Don't forget to follow us on Twitter and Instagram at Broadway Curtain.
And make sure to join our Facebook page at Behind the Curtain, Broadway's Living Legends.
Our guest this week is the unsung hero of 1970s musical theater revolutions. When Hal Prince and Stephen Sondheim changed the landscape of the musical theater with their ingenious direction and writing, they needed someone just as ingenious to cast their shows.
And that is where our guest this week comes in, as she was the original casting director on such groundbreaking projects as Company, Follies, A Little Night Music, and a show called Sweeney Todd, plus Evita, Mary Lee Roll-Along, and Into the Woods.
To tell us what it was like to work with such legends as Hal Prince, Stephen Sondheim, and Andrew Lloyd Webber, here is the brilliant casting director, Joanna Merlin.
Hello.
Hi, Joanna. Thanks so much for joining us.
And actor, and singer.
And teacher.
I mean, yes.
No.
Author.
First of all, I was not ingenious when I started. I didn't know what I was doing.
How did you get started? So was your family supportive of you being an actress? Because that's what you were originally, right?
And still am.
Yes. Oh, yes. Please forgive me. Still
that's
am.
Okay. Yeah. My mother was. My father was not.
Okay.
He was also not very excited about my coming to New York from L.A.
Uh-huh.
But my mother was wonderfully supportive, and I think if she had another life to live, she would have been an actress. So that helped.
Yeah.
But in any event, I knew from the time I was about 11 that that was what I wanted to do.
Because of Too Many Marys?
Oh, my
God. Was that
gosh,
something that you
where
did when you
get that?
I don't know. I picked it up somewhere.
Oh, my God.
Is that where you caught the bug, as
yes,
it were?
Yes. It was a little community theater production,
yeah.
And I won a prize. So I thought, well, this is a good choice.
And this is the Chicago area? Is that where you were
in
from?
Chicago, mm-hmm. Yeah. And I left Chicago when I was 15 and went to L.A.
With your family?
With
family
my family, yes, yes.
What
my,
did
whole family.
What did wow. what did your parents do for a living?
My father had a grocery store, and my mother also worked in the grocery store. They were born in Russia. My mother was a baby when she came, but my father was 17, so he still had a kind of heavy accent.
Where was he from?
He was from Belarus.
Belarus.
Uh-huh.
And she also, she was from a shtetl.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And so the idea of actually being in the theater and making a living in the theater was very far away
yes.
from my father particularly. In any event, I went to L.A. and was fortunate enough to study with Michael Chekhov.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah.
Who was
yeah.
Anton Chekhov's nephew and considered to be Stanislavski's most brilliant student. And it was just serendipity that I happened to meet him and that he took me into his class.
What, that was at UCLA?
It was before UCLA. Okay. Well, it was I was 18,
oh,
so
wow.
it was
Still
just about at the same time. And I studied with him for until he died.
What were those classes like? I mean, you are so, you know, a sponge for that kind of knowledge, I guess, especially learning to act at such a young
very,
age.
Very inspiring. He was relentless about opening the doors to one's inspiration, imagination, physicality. It was liberating.
Yeah.
It was very, very different than what was then taught in the training programs, which was the Strasbourg interpretation of Stanislavski, which focused on personal...
Right, the emotional...
Personal...
Recall, is that it? Yeah.
Personal psychological pain and whatever. And I don't mean to undermine his contribution because... Many, many wonderful actors studied with him, but it was a very different approach. And Chekhov said he thought acting should be fun and not torture.
Oh, I like that as well. I like
Works
that as well.
Too.
Now, before you went off to UCLA, were you able to see a lot of theater in Chicago?
I happened to see the original production of The Glass Menagerie.
What?
Can you please tell us what that was like?
Well, I was 10.
Okay.
But still.
But I still, you know, I have images of Laura Taylor and Eddie Dowling and Julie Hayden. They're just images, but I just remember being so... taken into that world.
Yeah.
And the first musical I saw, which was in Chicago, was Finian's Rainbow. And
yes.
I still remember some of those lyrics, because you know how the first musical has such deep impression on you.
Yes.
Yeah. And I've seen other productions of it, and somehow it brings it, you know, it all back, the first impression.
That's beautiful.
Of course. Did you sing? Were you singing then?
I am not a singer. The reason I got into Fiddler on the Roof was only because of Jerry Robbins. He just really wanted me in the show. Shall I tell you that story, or do you know that story?
No,
we don't know this story.
It's actually in the book I wrote on auditioning. I tell that story.
Oh, yes, I have that book. Yeah, great book, you guys.
In any event, I had met Jerry, or I auditioned for Jerry for Mother Courage, which was the show he did before Fiddler. Mm-hmm. And he called me in 4 times. I did not get the part. But when he was about to cast Fiddler, he called me in and we had a chat. And he said, I can really see you in this show. And I said, yeah, but I'm not a singer. And he said, oh, don't worry about it. It'll be fine. You don't have to be a singer. So I auditioned for Huddle. He saw me as Huddle for some reason. And I didn't have a soprano voice. I mean, it was not. I had sung once on stage with Laurence Olivier.
Yeah,
I can't wait to ask about that.
Yeah. In Beckett.
That's right, Beckett, 1961.
I played a lute and sang a Welsh folk song, but it was not very demanding vocally.
Okay. But I'm sure you didn't sing that for the audition of Fiddler.
No.
What did you sing?
Oh, no. Oh, I don't know. It was just some popular ballad.
Yeah.
Anyway, it was terrible. and they called me back. And somewhere around the 4th audition, he said, well, I want you to work with Jerry Bock and Sheldon Harnick, and I want you to learn Far from the Home I Love.
Yeah.
And I did, and it was terrible. And, you know, he just kept calling me back. The 7th audition, he said, I'd like to come to your singing lesson. I'd like to hear everything that you can sing. So he did. We went to my singing lesson with Carmen Gagliardi at 71st and Broadway.
Okay.
And, of course, Carmen Gagliardi was a little nervous, you know, to Jerry Robbins.
Jerome Robbins.
Yeah. But, and so was I. But anyways, I sang everything. And one of the songs I sang was Irma La Douce, which was in a jazz voice, you know, da-da-da-da-da-da. He said, oh, that's the song I want you to sing for the 8th audition. So.
The 8th?
Boy, when Jerry wants something, Jerry gets what he wants, you know.
Jerry Bock and Sheldon Harnick stood up and said, she's got a chess voice. She can sing Seidel.
So, oh, my gosh.
And so they wrote that little middle section, huddle, for me, because I had such a little range.
And that's why it's like...
And
that
that's
range.
Why it is the way it
that's,
is.
That's why...
Incredible. Amazing.
Anyway, so...
is it true you were in Cecil B. DeMille's Ten Commandments? Is that...
Yes.
Which commandment were you?
Yeah.
I was one of Yvonne DiCarlo's dancing sisters.
Oh.
I was awful.
How did that come about? And what was it like being on set with a legendary director like that?
Well, first of all, he didn't direct.
Oh, okay. Here we go.
Henry Wilcoxon, who was his associate director, did whatever directing there was, minimally. And DeMille composed these images based on 19th century biblical paintings. And it nearly killed me because I had to dance. We did this one little dance, but we were rehearsing it for 3 weeks. And I would come home every night and sit in a hot bath in pain because we would dance for 8 hours a day.
It's good to get all that Chekhov training because that's just like...
But anyway, it was quite an experience to be on the set with, 10,000 people.
What was auditioning like in those days? Because I know that you helped kind of transform what auditioning sort of became with casting directors and, were there casting directors when you came to New York, for instance?
Yes, there were casting directors.
And they were private?
Not as many, as many. Frequently, it would be done in the producer's office. There would be somebody who was doing the casting, among other things.
But so there was no independent casting director they usually
worked
for?
Very few. Sometimes for soap operas or industrial films, that kind of thing.
Yeah.
And we would, there were certain days when agents and casting directors would see you, like between 2 and 3 on Wednesdays. And so I would put my high heels in my bag and be wearing my sneakers and change, and hopefully leave a picture and resume. And maybe if I was lucky, I could say hello.
So you're cast in Fiddler on the Roof. What is that rehearsal process like?
Long.
It's a long process.
Very long. And it didn't stop when we went out of town. Opened in Detroit, Jerry would rehearse every day, and he kept rehearsing until the opening in New York.
Wow. Not going to stop.
No. But, he was a perfectionist.
For those of us who were not able to be in the room to watch him work, what made him such a good director?
Well, he understood the world of the play. I'm just talking about Fiddler, because that's the only time I worked with him. He asked very important and insightful questions of Joe Stein and Sheldon and Jerry in terms of what the show was about. You might have read about this because it's been written that, that he was not willing to settle for the simple story of Tevye and his daughters. It needed to be a much larger concept. And that's how Tradition came about, that great opening number. And so it's interesting that in the revival that's playing on Broadway right now, that Bart Scheer has framed it in a contemporary way because he's connecting it to the migrants. And so that is kind of an extension of what Jerry was trying to say about Tradition.
Did you have a lot of discussions as a cast about what was going on in Russia at that time? Or was it more...
Yes, we did. And also he took us to an Orthodox wedding. And to experience what that was like. And he brought in books and photographs of the shtetls. We really had a sense of what the life was. And it was very, very moving to me because that's where my family was from.
So personal.
Was your family able to see you? Were your parents able to see
you?
Yes. Good.
They flew here from L.A. and they were very excited. It was a great night.
Some other legends that were in that show with you, if you can just tell us a little bit about what it was like working with them, anything about their rehearsal methods, but Zero Mostel. We'll start with Zero Mostel.
You really want me to talk about Zero Mostel?
Yes, we do.
I had a hard time sometimes with Zero. I have enormous admiration for the fact that he was a comic phenomenal. Mm-hmm. He was. Mm-hmm. He was hilarious. But he was uncontrollable in terms of the shtick. We had this one little moment where we were in Washington before we opened, and my husband came down. So he came down, and we went out for an Italian dinner in between the matinee, the evening performance. And that night, in the last scene, when the daughters are leaving and we're all parting, and I come up to him with the baby in my arms and say goodbye, Papa, it already makes me cry.
Yeah.
And he whispers in my ear, "Don't eat garlic before you come on the stage." And I was just, I was so mad. After all, I was a serious actress.
Yeah. Yes.
I studied with Michael Chekhov. Yeah. No, but it was just, you know, I just was so inappropriate. And he was trying to break me up or something. And it was just the wrong moment.
Yeah.
And so the curtain came down. The curtain went up. We bowed. The curtain came down. Mm-hmm. And I said, "Zero, if you ever do that to me again, I'm going to kill you." Well, he did not like to be spoken to that way. And so the curtain went up, the curtain came down, and he started screaming at me in front of the entire company. Nobody knew what was going on. And he said, "You're a Jerry Robbins actress. I'm an ensemble actor." I mean, nothing could have been further from the truth.
Uh-huh.
But in any event, it was hard after that. It was hard. And I mean, we had to work together.
Of course.
And so,
exactly.
And of course you make it work.
And it wasn't, you know, it wasn't huge, but it really, a lot of people objected to the shtick. And even Hal went to him because in a lot of the reviews they objected to it and said, you know, this is disrespectful.
Right.
And he threw Hal out of the dressing room. I mean, he felt that he owned it. He owned the show, and he thought it would close as soon as he left, and it played for another 7 years.
Oh, yeah.
But in any event, he was so funny, but he knew that he was using his shtick. And when we did the Actors Fund performance for actors, he didn't do any shtick. He played it. He played it, and he was wonderful.
So he could.
The audience would laugh and laugh, and that would feed him.
Yeah.
And he would just go further.
Like a comedian,
but, you know, he was a brilliant comedian.
Yeah.
But it was just a sort of impulse control problem.
Yeah, totally.
How did you transition then from being an actress to a casting director?
Well, you know, I didn't actually transition. I continued when I could. I mean, I had two little kids.
Sure.
I said to Hal when he offered me the job, I had taken off about 3.5 years, with the exception of going back into the show. I went back in the show because he needed a replacement.
Yeah.
And when I went back in the show, my understudy was Bette Midler. Sometimes on off nights, she'd babysit with my daughter.
Nice.
In any event, the casting director, for some reason, didn't like Bette. And so when I left, she didn't want her to audition for Hal, because I think she'd probably been cast as the understudy by a stage manager.
Sure.
And so I called Hal, and I said, "Listen, I have this wonderful understudy, and I really think you should see her." So he saw her. She got the part. She played it for 4 years.
That's amazing. I don't know if she played it that long. I knew
four
she played it,
years.
But I had no idea.
And just recently in the revival, in the Times, they were doing an article about the revival, and they had quoted different people who'd had some connection with the show. And they quoted Bette, and she mentioned that I was had made it, said a nice thing about me and being a kind person. And so I managed to contact her. And so we've been emailing each other. And she said, "You opened the path to my career."
Totally.
Oh, how sweet.
Anyway, we're going to get together.
And that must have been, Hal must have seen then that you had these casting instincts. Then,
well, maybe that was it, you know. I mean, he didn't mention that. He just said he wanted somebody who liked actors. And since I was a Jewish mother and an actress, he figured I might be the right person.
She knows. She knows.
Company your first?
Company, I did not cast. I didn't come in until the middle, or even a little after the middle. So a lot of the principals had been cast. Mm-hmm. Cannot take credit for Elaine Stritch or, you know, Barbara Barry. But I did cast the rest of it. Mm-hmm. And And then I cast the tour. But I, you know, I literally had no idea what this was going to be like. Mm. And I called the woman who had been casting before me. And I said, could we have lunch? She said, listen, I left you some pictures and resumes. You'll figure it out. So wow. Thank you. I mean, rowing without an oar or whatever. Anyway, she was probably busy, what can I say? You know, what you do is you construct these files. Mm-hmm. And when you read the script, or this, I'll say what I do, right?
Yeah.
So I would read the script, and I would do a kind of a breakdown. Mm-hmm. And then I would talk to Hal about the people that I would suggest should come in for it, to see whom he knew and liked. Mm-hmm. And in that case, they would not have to do a preliminary audition.
Right.
And if they were people he didn't know, then I would do preliminaries with the musical director. Mm-hmm. And except for Company and... Oh, I think Follies. I think it was Hal Hastings for the first two shows.
Yeah, yeah.
Then I started working with Paul Gemignani, we had a really great relationship. And if an actor would come in whose singing was not exactly perfect for the role, but was really right for the role and a really good actor, I would ask Paul if he would work with him, if he would change the range or he would do something. And he would do the same for me. So that if he had, you know, a great singer who needed a little help. And so I think as a team, we were able to really find people who were able to do both on some level.
Yeah.
Well, you're also helping create artists, too. You weren't just letting them do their thing and let them go. But if you really saw a spark, then you guys helped develop them, too.
It was very exciting because sometimes, you know, actors would be very intimidated by the fact that they were not really legit singers.
Yeah.
And, I mean, for instance, Patricia Elliott in A Little Night Music, you know. I mean, a fabulous actress and wonderful for the Countess, but not really a singer.
Right.
And so, a little, you know, Every Day a Little Death, I mean, she could sing that, you know. And... and I'm sure that they might have changed the range a little bit for her. Mm-hmm. And and Hal had great instincts as a casting director. And that, of course, was very helpful because we frequently agreed.
That helps.
That helps, yeah.
When you first read Company, what was your reaction to it? Did you know it was going to be this groundbreaking new musical?
I thought it was so revolutionary. Mm. No chorus. Dealing with really substantive questions about marriage and about being single, and that it was really, I think, a real sea change in the musical theater.
Talk about some of the challenges of casting Follies.
Well, yeah, because Hal wanted old movie stars. Mm. He really felt that was the right way to go. And so I was going through these lists. And, you know, Yvonne DiCarlo actually was my older sister in Ten Commandments.
Yes, that's right. You were there.
One of the most exciting auditions of all was Ethel Chatté, who sang Broadway Baby. I mean, you know, she had been, I don't think she'd been working for a long time, you know. And she was in her probably at least mid to late 70s.
I'm not
quite sure how old she was. Yeah. But when she sang Broadway Baby, I mean, she brought the house down.
Did you get starstruck seeing these great actors walk into the room? Or
I was more starstruck with Stephen Sondheim, frankly.
Ain't that the truth?
We all are.
Ain't that the truth?
I mean, I think I was always a little shy around Steve. just because, you know, his genius was so amazing.
Praised by Lin-Manuel Miranda as the future of musical theater, SUFS creator Shayna Taub makes Broadway history as only the second woman to write the book, music, lyrics, and star in her own original new musical. Don't miss the much-anticipated Broadway debut of the singular artist that Forbes calls visionary and Billboard anoints as one of the most inventive voices in musical theater. SUFS, the original new musical from Shayna Taub, is now playing on Broadway at the Music Box Theater. Get your tickets today at SuffsMusical.com. The Outsiders on Broadway tells the story of finding where you belong when the world refuses to accept you. Based on S.E. Hinton's beloved novel, featuring new music from Jamestown Revival and Justin Levine, and directed by Danya Taymor, Entertainment Weekly says that, with brilliant staging and some of the most captivating stage fighting currently on Broadway, The Outsiders has the power to inspire an entire generation. Get your tickets today at OutsidersMusical.com.
Can I talk about Pacific Overtures?
Let's get there. Yes.
It's hard to say which is my favorite show because I really am I'm so totally dyed-in-the-wool Sondheim fan now.
Us too.
Hard for
us
me to
too.
Watch a musical that anybody else wrote. But anyway, Pacific Overtures originally was a non-musical. It was a play by John Wideman, and Hal was directing it, and I was casting it, and the Asians were Asians and the Caucasians were Caucasians. And I had a really hard time because there were very few Asians who had been in the profession, right. Even with Flowered Drum Song, a lot of them were Caucasians.
Right.
Anyway, so on the final day of auditions, Hal called me in the morning and said, cancel the auditions. It's going to be a musical.
Whoa.
I said, what? I mean, even originally, a play about Admiral Perry opening Japan to the world. Yeah, I mean, I thought, why is he doing this? Really? And then a musical. So I spent a year actually casting it because I had to find 35 Asian men. Hal wanted everybody to be Asian, the women to be played by men.
Right.
They had to sing, they had to dance, they had to act, and a lot of it was, very traditional movements.
Yeah.
And so, I mean, I was looking everywhere, San Francisco and L.A. and Chicago and New York, and we finally were able to cast it. And in the meantime, Steve was writing the score.
Mm-hmm.
And there was one afternoon that is just such a vivid image. He has a kind of sunroom in his house, and he called some of us, Hal, obviously, and the various people connected with the show in to listen to some of the score. And I remember hearing it for the first time and just thinking, this man is such a genius. How did he, it's just such an extraordinary score. The combination of being, they called it kind of Broadway kabuki.
Yes,
they did.
And the combination of Japanese musicians, right. The orchestra, and then when it was mounted, I mean, they had gotten the fabrics from Japan, and Boris Aronson designed this unbelievable set. And the actors were so excited to be on Broadway working with Steve and Hal. I mean, these were Asian actors who had many, there were few of them from LA that had done television, Hawaii 5-0.
Sure.
And also there was a group called East West Players out there that was headed by Mako, who then became the narrator.
Oh, wow.
But many of them were like nightclub performers, comics, half Asian, Filipino. I mean, we had a kind of a broad umbrella over the word Asian, but they were basically all Asian. There was one that I think lied to me, said his grandmother was Asian. However, he was the last person to cast, so I just closed my eyes.
Just look the other way.
Anyway, that was kind of, we're talking about Steve's genius, and the other thing is that in every one of his plays, there's a completely different world. His insight into each one of those is so deep.
It's incredible.
He used to ride his bike to the auditions, and I was so scared that he would get hit by a car. Ride his bike all over New York.
That's the Jewish mother instinct,
Dad. It's a lot of that.
Were you still casting the touring companies and the road companies of these shows as well, or would you just do the original Broadway production and then?
No, I did the tour of into the woods. And Pacific Overtures, we just took the whole company because the show didn't run very long.
Unfortunately.
I think that the audiences weren't ready. The sophistication, the, you know, that world, it wasn't as commercial as, you know, a lot of other shows.
Did you have a strong attachment to this particular cast? It seems like you...
I did, because it was such an event for them. Yeah. And they were all hoping that this was like the beginning of a real career, and of course it wasn't.
Yeah.
You know, they would get cast in commercials, and you know, a few of them did, you know, had some work. But in general, it was tough because, you know, the commercial theater, television, and film does not cast a lot of Asians. They still don't.
Yes.
Unfortunately, true.
Yeah. It's a the state's a very supportive community. They very much look out for each other.
Yeah.
They
and
do.
And East-West Players is still in Los Angeles, and they're thriving.
Yeah.
They're thriving, but theaters like them are few and far between, which is unfortunate. Tell us a little bit about On the 20th Century, which is a fun show.
It's a wonderful show. And as a matter of fact, I thought the revival was terrific.
Oh, yeah.
So did I. I thought it was wonderful.
Hear that score again.
Yes.
Hear the comedy again.
She was perfectly cast, I thought. I thought it was incredibly well cast.
And Peter Gallagher. That was wonderful.
Also.
But how fun
no wrong in my book.
Find Kevin Klein. And, well, we actually spoke with Judy Kay. She was one of our first
Judy Kay was one of our first guests.
Yeah.
I had always heard, I don't know if this is true, that Hal Prince had said that when he was casting Madeline Kahn, he thought he was casting Bernadette Peters.
I don't know. I'd never heard that.
So you can't comment on it.
No, I can't comment on it. But at one point, I mean, Madeline Kahn sort of came with the project.
She came with the project.
When I started. And there was at one point a problem with her contract. It was produced by Bobby Fryer, among others. And so they were kind of secretly looking for somebody else.
Mm.
And one of the people we were looking at, I'd heard Meryl Streep sang. This was before...
Mm-hmm. Before she was...
And so I had these secret conversations, telephone conversations in the dressing room with her agent. But she didn't have the high. She couldn't go up that high. But anyway, it all worked out. And Madeline was so divine. Well, I tell you the Kevin Klein story.
Please.
It's also in the auditioning book.
Yes.
When I first started casting, I was going to Juilliard a lot because of their first class, John Houser was running Juilliard. And the first class was Kevin Klein and Patti LuPone and a lot of other David Ogden Stiers. Anyway, so I went to see a lot of their productions because I was trying to find young actors, you know. And so I saw Kevin and Patti perform a lot, and then they went off for 4 years with the acting company tour. Then they came back, and Kevin did a production of Robber Bridegroom but that was the only musical that he'd done. So in any event, I called him in for Bruce Granite for On the 20th Century, and he disobeyed all of the auditioning rules. He came in a full costume. White suit, a white overcoat over his shoulders, a fedora, and no script. I mean, you never come to an audition without a script, because if you forget your lines, you're up the creek. So anyway, he came in, and he was doing the scene with Madeline Kahn, and he... The stage manager was this guy with glasses, and he grabbed the stage manager and kissed him right on the lips. Another thing you never do. So anyway, he was clearly brilliant, right? And I brought him into Hal, and, you know, Hal was blown away, offered him the part. And his agent didn't think the part was big enough because originally there was no song and he was under, you know, he was not one of the stars over the title or whatever. So his agent didn't want him to do it. So I called Kevin into the office. I said, listen, you're going to be working with Hal. Hal has a wonderful gift for recognizing talent, and I cannot guarantee it, but I bet you're going to get a song, and I bet it's going to be a bigger part, and you really should not pass this up. So I have to take a little credit.
As well you should.
And he's given me, he has actually given me credit. Of course, he was great. He won a Tony.
I was going to say.
Yeah, it worked out pretty well
for him. He did pretty good for himself.
Yeah, but it was by disobeying all of the rules. But it's the sort of thing, you have to be somebody as good as Kevin Kline.
To disobey the rules.
To disobey the rules.
That's the rule. That's the lesson here. Yes.
Imogene Coca, one of my favorite actresses.
Oh, divine. Divine. Yeah, yeah. She auditioned. You know,
she came
in. She came in, she was, and she really was, she was fabulous. It's, yeah, I don't, it's hard to see anybody else play that part, because she was so.
Oh, yeah, you can see.
Quirky and crazy.
Sweeney Todd.
Yeah, Sweeney Todd.
Beast, a different type of beast.
Glorious show, glorious show. Well, Len and Angela were sort of connected to the show right in the beginning, so I didn't have to cast those two parts, because you couldn't do much better than that.
Yeah.
What I do remember is that at the first reading, Steve provided the lunch for everybody, and they were meat pies. Everybody was a little reluctant to eat.
Wow. That's funny.
That's very funny.
No, I was going to ask about Evita.
Yeah.
To Evita, because you had done so many Sondheim shows, of course, with Hal, and then all of a sudden we have a different voice with Andrew Lloyd Webber, slightly, you know, and more of a pop-infused score, I would have to say. So I wonder if you had to sort of... expand your files a little bit. With,
yeah, what's
you know,
that collaboration like?
Yeah.
Well, as I said, it was very hard to find women who could, who had that high chest voice.
And it was always set up there. I mean, like you.
Yeah.
That was the, because it had already been done in London. That's right, I guess. So.
It had been done. I went to see it in London.
Yeah.
And Hal gives a Christmas party every year.
Uh-huh.
Still does.
Yep.
I see him every year. It's his Christmas party and Steve. Anyway, because Kevin and Patty had been a couple, and so he invited Kevin to the Christmas party.
Kevin Kline.
Kevin Kline. And I'd known them just, you know, known Patty just because of Juilliard thing and stuff. And so we were having a talk, you know, and she had been doing non-musicals, you know, the Juilliard. And I said, oh, do you sing, you know? Or she might have mentioned that she sang or something. And I said, what's your voice like? She said, well, I don't know. It's sort of a, you know, I sing kind of in a high, low kind of alto chest kind of thing. And I said, oh, you sing fairly high? She said, yeah, I do. I said, well, how would you like to audition for Evita?
Christmas party, amazing.
Oh my God. And that audition, the final day of auditions, it was, we had had a blizzard in New York.
Yeah.
The snow was piled up high.
Uh-huh.
And everybody was struggling to get there.
Yeah.
And the theater had no heat. It was freezing. And Andrew Lloyd Webber was there, and Tim Rice was there, and Hal, and everybody else, and we're sitting there drinking hot liquids, you know, trying to warm our hands and our stomachs. And anyway, Patty came in. She flew in from California, which was doing something, and she had three different outfits for the three songs she was singing.
Oh.
Right? And, of course, you know, it was just, there was no question.
What about Mandy Patinkin?
Well, it's another story.
We love stories.
Actually, I mean, the three people that I kind of take a little credit for are Patty and Kevin and Mandy.
And you shouldn't.
Mandy was not available to come until the final day, and nobody had heard him sing. And he didn't read music. So they taught him High Flying Adored right there on the stage. And he was just kind of reading the notes, and he had heard the music once, and he has such an incredible ear. And Tim Rice said, he'd been playing in London for a year, the show, and he said, I've never heard that song sung so well. But Mandy was very scared because he'd never done a show like this, never done a musical like this. And he used to call it a skit. He wouldn't call it a Broadway show. He'd call it it's a skit. It's just a skit.
A skit.
It's not, you know, whatever. And, of course, he was so fantastic in it. And the two of them, Patty and Mandy, formed a really close relationship. They were bonded.
Mm-hmm.
And, of course, then they did the show together recently.
Yeah, they do a two-person show.
And they talked about Evita.
What excites you in an audition?
What excites me is when an actor really is in the moment and lets something happen, and it's not planned. It doesn't feel prepared.
Yes.
It may have been prepared, but the best thing an actor can do is to do all of the preparation and then walk into the audition and forget about it and just be in that moment and create their own. I mean, sometimes you walk into an audition and the atmosphere is kind of yuck. It's kind of, you know, they don't say hello. And it's understandable. I mean, from the other point of view, if you're seeing hundreds of people, you know, you can't be totally gracious to everybody. And so the actor has to create their own, something I call a performance consciousness, so that they are not influenced by what they're projecting is going on, because they don't know. You never know. I mean, sometimes directors, casting directors, producers can fall in love with the audition, but they're not necessarily going to express it because they haven't talked to each other, they haven't made a decision, they don't want the actor to feel you've got the job, you know. And so there has to be some kind of neutral atmosphere, although sometimes when somebody is really great and it's so clear, you know, they can't control their enthusiasm.
Of course.
No, it's neutral.
What advice would you give an actor who's just graduating college and is just coming to New York for the first time? You know, if there's one thing you would like them to know before they start making the rounds?
Well, it's hard to make the rounds these days. I mean, you really just have to go to whatever open auditions you can go. I know that's what you meant, but to kind of suss out where are the good off Broadway theaters and try to work wherever you can to get as much experience you can, and also to try to create your own theater. I mean, this is something that is happening more and more. People devise their own theater. I mean, you know, it's tough. You have to find a place. You have to find some money. But a lot of actors have really started to take this profession into their own hands because it's hard to get an agent. Agents can only handle a certain number of people. And so, you know, most of them have day jobs. And I think they all know it's not easy, but they don't really experience how tough it is until they get here.
Yeah.
But there are more jobs now, you know, because television is so huge. Half of their auditions really are on television. And those auditions are harder to get because you really have to have representation. An agent or, and now managers are kind of behaving a little more like agents, and so that's another way of getting representation. But it's hard to get seen in something that really shows you off, and so it sometimes takes a long time. My feeling is that if they're really talented and they really work at it, continue to study, continue to watch films and television and analyze the actors that are really, really good and inhabit the roles. I think it's also important for them to be involved in the world in some way.
Yeah.
I think that
well-rounded.
A lot of them have free time. And I think volunteering, working with kids, working with groups that need help, working with seniors, it is all, I mean, we, as actors, we reflect human behavior.
That's right.
And the more connections they can make with people outside of the business, real people, sometimes watching documentaries is a great thing to do, you know? But the other advice is if there's anything else that you love to do, think about it.
Do it. How has the world of casting changed since you first started doing it?
Well, I haven't done it now for 25 years.
No, but still.
But what I know is that it's just all online.
Yeah. Do you like that?
Well, fortunately, I don't have to do it because the technology might intimidate me. But it's much more. It's much easier, really, for the casting directors. They can put all of their files online. I mean, I had tons of drawers of and for the now you have these breakdown services. And when I was casting, I did all the breakdowns. I wrote them out. and I sent them out in envelopes with stamps to the agents. Yeah, I mean, so it's much easier now.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
And much more efficient. And actors can actually send their photos and resumes online. They don't have to have a hard copy. I mean, they do need to have them just in case they need them, but mostly it's online. And so it's much better for the actors, and it's much better for the casting directors. Yeah. Also, they can do little videos.
Yeah.
Send the reel. I mean, they used to have to deliver these DVDs, of their reels. Yeah. And
I know that, you know, in this business, it's not about awards, but would you like to see a casting director get a Tony Award, a category for?
I certainly would. You know, I worked with the Casting Society of America for a long time, and we were fighting for casting directors to get more recognition because, I mean, as Hal said, it's 90% of the success of the show is the casting. But it's very hard for people to understand the difference between casting and directing.
Yeah.
And but you know, the Casting Society of America has awards, and
the Emmys, I think. Do the Emmys give out an award for casting, or am I making that up? I know the Academy Award does not.
No, they don't.
Which is horrible. And I don't think the Tony Awards.
I don't think the Emmys do, but sometimes the actors mention the casting director, which is nice.
They should, and
these Artios Awards are really nice. And as a matter of fact, Bernie Telsey just won the Hoyt Bowers Award,
which is
terrific. Yeah.
You've always been an actor as well. I feel like sometimes in show business, it likes to pigeonhole people as one or the other. Have you ever had a hard time going from casting director to actor to casting director?
You know, that really worried me because I was still acting when I was casting. And so what I found was that sometimes I'd be in a reception room with an actor I had auditioned. And I thought, oh, they must hate me for trying to take a job away from them. Yeah. But what I found was that they felt that I was putting myself on their level of someone who was vulnerable enough to try to get a job and be rejected.
And go through that process,
And so it turned out to be okay. Huh. I mean, I wasn't acting, you know, a lot, but I was still doing television and film. And
can I ask you about Shelter?
Yeah.
The musical. This is a musical written by
Gretchen Cryer
and Nancy Ford in 1984, I want to say.
I'm not sure of the date, actually. Yeah,
it was early 80s.
And directed by my muttle, Austin Pendleton.
Oh,
I love him.
Tell us a little bit about that, this little sort of gem of a forgotten musical, perhaps.
Yeah, well, fortunately, I didn't have to sing.
You have a great chess voice. We found that out.
Yes, I know.
It was fun, and I think the score was really lovely. But I think the book was the problem, and it wasn't a good enough book. But the cast was fun: Terry Kaiser, Marsha Rod. And Susan Browning.
Uh-huh. Yeah. Oh, yes.
So it ran about 5 weeks, and it was just, you know, it was fun to do. I was still casting at the time. It was disappointing.
You had done almost all Sondheim shows. You did Into the Woods in 86, 87, but you didn't do Sunday in the Park with George.
No, I didn't. I didn't. The only time I worked with James Lapine was Into the Woods.
Oh, I see.
I had left Hal by that time, and I was doing mostly casting films.
Ah, how did that transition come about?
Well, that transition came about because of Pacific Overtures, because I knew all the Asian actors, and I was the only one in New York who did. And so Michael Cimino hired me to do Year of the Dragon. Bernardo Bertolucci hired me to do The Last Emperor.
Yes.
So that's how I got into films, and then I cast for Merchant Ivory. And
Big Trouble in Little China, one of my favorite movies.
Oh, you're kidding.
Oh, no, really? We grew up with it, and we love it.
That was like epic for me. When I saw that, I thought, oh my gosh, she did Big Trouble in Little China. But now that makes sense. It all started because of Pacific Overture.
It did, it did.
That you got to know.
Right, right.
Wow. And then... very good. Merrily, can you tell us a little bit about that casting process? A beautiful show.
One of my favorites.
That score, isn't that
fantastic?
It's
amazing.
It is.
It's perfection.
Every single one of those songs is so amazing. It was Hal's concept that that they would use, since the show goes backwards, that they would use young people who would end up being their own age, but who would start, 20 years later. Somehow or another, it just didn't work. And also, I think there's an inherent problem in the story, because first of all, you don't like the leading character until he gets to be young
at
the second act.
And
what was wonderful was that Lonnie Price, who played Franklin, was an intern in the office. He would get the coffee and he would be the assistant. He was a kid, and we auditioned him, I mean, that was his first real, as far as I know, his first real, really big show. I'm sure it's true. He was so wonderful in the show, and I love him. And he's such a good director.
He's a great,
he's directing Sunset Boulevard in London.
Yeah.
Oh, okay.
He's doing pretty good for himself.
Yeah.
But
and
always.
He's so great.
Yeah.
Lovely guy. Just so humble.
And a young unknown named Jason Alexander.
Found him, huh?
Yes. He was really hilarious and Merrily.
I mean, that cast, it's Lonnie and Jason Alexander, but also Tanya Pinkins, I believe, was in it. And Liz Calloway.
Yes.
Was in it.
Yep.
Yeah.
They were all very young. And, it was really hard because we were looking at kids who had no resumes. I mean, teenagers sometimes, high school kids. So kids heard about it nationally, and they came from all over the country to these open auditions. Mm-hmm. And there was one audition where we had about 1,500 kids. They came and they slept in the halls overnight, and they didn't want to lose their place in lines.
Oh my
they
goodness.
Didn't eat, and one girl came in and she threw up. I mean, it was they were so excited to be there, but it was really it was a phenomenon, and so disappointing for them.
But many of them have gone on to have really wonderful careers, and so you and Al and Steve launched some really, really nice things for a lot of people. Was Into the Woods the last Broadway production you cast?
Yes.
Tell us a little bit about working with James Lapine in that relationship, because you worked with Hal Prince for so long, and what's it like working with Mr. Lapine?
Well, it was great. He's very different than Hal. I mean, but they're both wonderful directors. Right. And of course, James also is a writer, and that made a difference because it was his script and his concept working with Steve. And but again, there was a real team between Hal and Steve and James and Steve.
Yeah.
And I think that's what made those shows so wonderful also, is that it was, they were on the same page.
True collaboration.
Yeah.
And I loved working with James. I mean, we worked together for about 2.5 years. What was also exciting is that when Bernadette left, I had just founded the Non-Traditional Casting Project about inclusion in the arts.
Yeah.
And so I brought Felicia Rashad in to replace her.
Yes. Brilliant
and so
casting.
She played the witch.
Yeah.
And that was, it was early in casting actors of color on Broadway.
Yeah. What can the industry do better in terms of that? Because it's, I mean, it still happens today. So what would you like to see happen? What do you think needs to happen?
Well, I just think they need to open the doors to more actors of color and actors with disabilities. Mm-hmm. I think Spring Awakening was a major, major leap forward. In seeing actors with disabilities. Casting directors are really trying to have directors cast, try to change their thinking in terms of casting. One of the problems is that if they're doing an original show, writers have a certain idea about the casting. And, I mean, if it's an all-white cast. And so they often feel their original production needs to be cast that way, but that other productions following that, they could conceivably see it. But television and film have done much more non-traditional casting than in theater. Mm-hmm. And I think the reason is because of the audiences, that there are more white people who go to theater, and there is a large percentage of people with color who watch television and film. And so they're catering to those audiences. But I think Hamilton is making a huge contribution.
It's really going to change it and say that, hey, it was a different way.
This past season was a great season for diversity on Broadway, because there's Allegiance, there's Hamilton, there's Spring Awakening.
Yeah.
A lot of good good things happening.
Yeah, there's been progress.
So
Steps in the right direction. There's still, we live in a racist country, you know, and our arts often reflect that.
Yeah.
Certainly our, show business reflects that. Not the arts, but the business.
Yeah.
And that's tough. That's tough. But, you know, I think things, since we started the Non-Traditional Casting Project, which is now Alliance for Inclusion in the Arts, things have really changed. Not that we were totally responsible, but that we had something to do. Something to do with it. And and when we had a symposium to demonstrate it, James Earl Jones played Big Daddy and with a white brick. And that kind of had an enormous effect on the people who were watching. So it's happening, but, you know, there's still a lot of work to do.
It was an absolute pleasure getting to speak to you today.
Thank you. Well, it's lovely to go back to that golden period of Hal and Steve.
And you. We're throwing you in there with the two of them. It's a triangle of brilliance. Join us next week when we interview 42nd Street star Leroy Reams.
They say well-behaved women seldom make history. Just ask the Supps. A vibrant and wholly original new musical, Supps celebrates the real women who changed history and their story that is more timely than ever. See the show Variety calls an epic tour de force new musical. Deadline Cheers is a rare Broadway feat and leaves audiences inspired to keep marching. Supps has arrived on Broadway, and not a moment too soon. Get your tickets today at suppsmusical.com. If you love Broadway gossip, you are not going to want to miss any episode of this podcast, Singular Sensation, The Triumph of Broadway. Plenty of dramas unfold on stage, but the best dramas unfold backstage. And there were no bigger dramas than behind the scenes of Sunset Boulevard.
So you were being crucified over here, but not there.
No. No, because I was turning in a performance that would get standing ovations. Excuse me.
So check out my podcast, Singular Sensation, for all the juicy and gory details of Sunset Boulevard.